Now, I've been wanting to record a podcast for a few days now, a few weeks, and apparently the app here was not connecting with the server, with my microphone, with everything else, so I've been delayed a little bit, and it's actually worked out pretty well. I wanted to give all of my listeners out there a chance to think about life in these days, you know, this new normal. I've tried to do what my old friend and teacher Ram Dass would do, which is to say in so much speak that I think that the changes that have happened in our lives, and sitting here at my microphone, it's very much aware to me just exactly what those changes are, because we've all, in one way or another, had something totally be different in our lives. And a cup of coffee here. Start the morning right. Be it the loss of a loved one, be it your favorite restaurant being closed, be it not being able to find food, be it whatever. We've all been through this together, all of us. I was reading a lot of poetry lately. I've been doing this quarantine sessions of poetry, and I'm stuck with Twitter. On Facebook, I can do a little bit longer. On here, I could do very long. Reading some of my poetry and reading some of the poetry that other people have written and have inspired me, and keeping it alive based on a challenge that Patrick Stewart made to all of us to try and keep literary devices and these influences in our lives valid. The meaning behind it, because he went over with Shakespeare's sonnets, which Shakespeare wrote during a pandemic, is the idea that when we're stuck in these situations, we lose our sense of what reality can be a little bit. And as a psychologist, I know that I've seen this a lot with clients that have been locked in a setting for months at a time or dealing with different things. So my point to all of it was to share a little bit of beauty with everybody once in a while here. And Twitter limits me to like about 43 to 48 seconds, depending on how it's recorded. I'm not exactly sure how that works or why it's limited. It's kind of like tweeting it. I've always been a very vocal person, so when I go to write something, I'm writing a very long, worked out, thought out thought process, very much the same way in an outline and then broken down like a term paper. I don't have that option on Twitter. It's like, okay, you have to say what it is right here. Keep it simple, keep it sweet. And one of the nice things about going between Twitter and Facebook is I have that ability to look at my ideas briefly and look at them in a more opened up sense. And that does work well in that outline format, because an outline will show you exactly what you need. And Twitter can get you into some trouble because you can't expound upon some of your thoughts and the thought process in general. What it has shown me in writing is something I've always told people that want to become writers or want to become artists or musicians. Music, it's a little different. To me, I've always had this idea that the rhythm, because I couldn't learn phonically, I learned rhythmically how to read and write. The rhythm of it always came naturally to me, so I never really had a huge problem with it. What I find, if you want to become a writer, is to see what works. Don't let it influence you. Let it guide you what other people's thoughts have been. Don't consider these as words written by literary icons, because in their lifetime they were not literary icons. A lot of your famous musicians and the songs that they're best known for were practically nobodies at the time when they were recorded. And that sense of authenticity is what you want to learn. You never want to fall back on what you've done. All these books or all these songs or all these things you've done should always be alive in the moment. So, what I've been doing, naturally with my own writing, I don't need to rewrite it down and copy it, but let's say I wanted to read a Wordsworth poem. I know it's going to get within that 43-second area. So it's probably about 3 to 4 stanzas, maybe 5. If I read it fast, and I don't like, some of them had to read fast. I don't like that because of the fact that it condenses it and it lets me lose that sense of some of your best readings of poetry can be one stanza that lasts 43 seconds. Focusing on each word, the meaning, the delivery, the timing. And you lose some of that when you're limited. But I'm going to stick that 5 stanza part and say this is one thought. The beginning of the poem, opening, the middle that breaks down all the different... I want to say musical senses of chord, note, word... Because in a way, they're all very relative. And it breaks it down and it makes it into a formula that when it ends, you learn something or you feel something or you can say that this spoke to me. Music does that with notes. I think everybody that writes music should look at how other things are written. With country music, you have a couple chords. With classical music, you have notes. Depending on the instrument you're playing. And if you're singing, you're combining all that. But I take those 5 stanzas. The longer things I haven't really done a lot of. I've done some. But you write it out by hand. You get the feel for each word. And when you do that, you have an understanding of what and how it was written out by the person writing it, what they were feeling at the time is as they wrote it. And then when you actually read it and give a delivery, it actually has that sense that as if you wrote it yourself. In the same way, if you're a musician, you always learn other people's songs. The same thing. I'm not going to pick up a poem I've never read and start reading it to you and think that I have that delivery of it. You have to familiarize yourself with your work, familiarize yourself with it all. And that's really what good music and good writing is defined by. So I've been doing a lot of this, and then like a lot of your people that are cover bands or people that read other people's work, break into the next level where they try to do it themselves and then take what works for them. Come up with their own style. This is the very reason I've always said in a very short phrase, go to college, learn a lot of crap, and learn how to not do it. I've summed up in those words exactly what I've said in the past 9 minutes. But that's actually what it is, becoming aware of what works. All of your painters that were cubists or surrealists or impressionists all learned how to paint the earlier stuff that people had learned. They learned how to do a lot of the impressionists, what TV screens and photos and things were recreating. And they said, well, why would I want to sit here and do a painting if I can take a camera and take a picture? I want to do something different. That's a creative process in general. And then when you break into, most notably on my mind, is John Prine's last song, I Remember It All, where this very personal poetic song. I call it poetic because there's so much poetry in that song. And if you've ever heard half of what John Prine has written and sang, he alludes to other songs and other parts of his life and probably a lot of personal things in his life that his family and friends and people relate to. You get that sense of, with very few words, he's putting it all out there and he's leaving it in your mind. It's a amazing piece by a man who just recently passed away from COVID-19. So I think the expression that I've done with these readings is good for my soul and good for all yours. I did one last week. I did a bunch up in Erie on a beach. And I didn't go to the beach like with these people going in groups, not wearing a mask, none of that. I don't live very far from Erie. I drove there. I did not eat anywhere. I did not speak to anyone. I did not go near anyone. I did not use any public bathrooms. I just know my way up there. I know where all the real private, quiet beaches are that nobody goes to. And I went up there and I spent the day with nobody around me at all. And I came home. So it wasn't like I was putting myself at risk or anybody else. I wanted with some of these nautical poems to do it in an environment for myself and my soul, because for those of us that don't have that opportunity to live close to a beach, the state park really gives you that sense of the natural beauty more than some touristy beach. Touristy beach should be a swear word, I think. So back again, this new normal, you know, we're trying to deal with. What has COVID-19, which has killed so many beautiful and wonderful human beings? That I remember when this all started, I gave a lot of information to podcasts, asking people what they thought, what they felt, giving them advice on how to be safe and imploring with people to wear a mask. I wanted a feedback, and I've got a lot of feedback, and I'd say for the most part, a lot of people are taking this very seriously. A lot of people aren't. But what it's shown me is just the incredible value of human life. And I spent the past few weeks doing some poetry readings in different places. One in particular, I read in a cemetery at the grave of a man that it so happened I walked by his grave a couple years ago. I was up there with my great aunt and doing research for the family tree. And this is a guy I'm not related to. I felt drawn to it, to his name, and I wrote it down. It's very odd. I wrote it down in my notebook. I felt a feeling that I should look this guy up. And when I did, I found this letter that he had written to this young woman that was leaving town. And you have to understand, Cherry Tree in Indiana County, Pennsylvania at that time was very rural, but he was a businessman, younger man. Kingsport was his name. And he had been writing this girl this letter. She's leaving town. And he starts out talking like with large words. He's pushing over, compensating himself. He's talking to her about how, you know, just the nuances of Victorian language. Actually, way before pre-Victorian language. It's like 1850s. But he had that sense of almost a Wordsworth or a Lord Byron. And he starts out talking to this girl, and he takes every incentive to speak about their time together. They're growing up how she's the most beautiful woman he's known, and they're really good friends, and he's walking this very fine line. And then he wants to read her this poem, and it's a very beautiful poem. And then he ends the letter telling her, you know, if you leave, we never see again. It just kind of like breaks down into this quote of, it's a quote of a Roman or Greek. And anyhow, the poem was beautiful, and I had copied it out, and I wanted to really feel what he felt. And when I went to his grave, I read it, and I noticed all these other graves have the same date on it. So I researched that more, and I realized the man passed away from a pandemic. And you have this very sad realization that this was probably the last and only thing he'd written. It had been kept because this woman, think about this, you always wonder where the letter came from. Well, he wrote it to her, and she obviously kept it because this young man had passed away from this pandemic, and he was remembered by this. So I read it at his grave, and I was allowed to get the sense that between these two people, I was feeling what they felt for one another. And it's over 170 years, I believe. So the power of that poem was so poignant in how it touched me. I read that, and I was thinking about, in a roundabout way, not these other diseases, but what we're dealing with right now. And I want to go back to some of the things like my teacher Ram Dass and Wayne Dyer and different people would, even Frank Sinatra would say. I belonged to an organization, and I was just saying recently, or a very strange incident that happened, that Frank Sinatra always believed in people. He always believed that his music and the songs that he sang was you and that one person in the audience. It was always a one-to-one thing. And Wayne Dyer and Ram Dass, it's a very different views. Both of which I see the full spectrum of. One of the things I learned the most from Ram Dass after his stroke was that he went from being a very fast-speaking man that would put his words very quickly and his ideas very quickly to one that, because of his limitations, would take the time. And those pauses gave you a sense of what mattered. And he just passed away a couple months ago. So you contextualize what has this taught us. And right now we're dealing with a cultural realization with these protests over Black Lives Matter, over Indigenous lives, over all these different movements. It's just seeing that all those artificial things really didn't hold their grasp to identity. And it's the psychology of it, the psychology of poetry, psychology of music, and what is authentic as well. The thought process and the paradigm shift that when you go from being controlled and influenced by others to being influenced by your own personal meaning of life, and you've always had it your whole time. It's a paradigm shift that not everybody can make, because fundamentally and spiritually, everybody's at their own point in life. What I may feel now may take somebody at 10 years old to feel, or somebody at 60 to feel the realization of. And in the same respect, it might not always translate properly. The spiritual lessons, I would like to put it, and lessons of self-knowledge that we all have. This is best described when my father was a district supervisor of household finance and GE Credit Corporation. He was a manager, and he liked to golf. And so he had gotten this job because Arnold Palmer, who was a good friend of the family, the same with Fred Rogers, Arnold Palmer's father, Deke, put in a good reference for him. And my father was very good at his job. He went into all these offices and he made them all to where everything was set up the same way. You could go in any office and run it. There was nothing ran different in one office than the other. Very logical. He was a man that could relate to a CEO of a company, or he could relate to the ditch digger or somebody in any aspect, because he always saw people for who they were. And this lesson he always said to me was, you know, all these things in your life, all these merits, wait till this truck goes by. All these merits. I love my grandfather was a truck driver, so that's strange that talking about the people who are the salt of the earth that are working these jobs and are essential workers right now. Okay, that's what I was going to get to. But my father always said that those big prestigious titles and awards and things you've done and all this are just something that's going to go in your obituary. It's not going to define you. If you can't go in life and relate to the average person, and speak to them on a one-on-one basis, you're not going to be effective at anything. So what my father meant by that is something I've always taken very seriously, because he was district supervisor of household finance. And there were three. He had the whole East Coast, there was a guy that had the whole West Coast, and there was a guy in the Central United States that ran that office. And it so happened that household finance, particularly, I'm thinking, that was household finance, went under. The guy on the West Coast was making bad loans. He was making loans to these farms. He was giving them big loans for farm equipment that, when it came time 10 years later or 5 years later to collect on, the equipment wasn't worth anything. It was all worn out, and you couldn't collect on them. So anyhow, that's not the important part of it. The important part was my father went from having this job where he was at the first Super Bowl, sitting in the skybox with clients and eating T-bone steaks, golfing anywhere he wanted to not having a job. But that didn't bother him so much. He was extremely upset that all the people that he knew that worked under him, that were people he liked and looked up to and saw every day and respected, were out of a job as well. And I think that was what upset him the most. Whereas some of the other people, the one guy killed himself. The other guy went totally bonkers and was in a mental institution. And my father decided to go golfing and fishing. And he said, you know, there was a little spot, and I have to think about where it was at. I don't know if it was the Wilmore Dam. No, it wasn't Wilmore Dam. I mean, one lake up towards Erie, or if it was the Allegheny River. But he would go to this spot, and there was a church. Was across the other bank. You could see the cross. He said, you know, that was my church. That was where I found my sense of belonging, spirituality, and my sense of peace. And he said, I just stand there and talk to God. And this is a guy that grew up a Catholic. That's a big step. A different direction. So what this, and I'm gearing at, is all these jobs, because my father had one. There's so many jobs people identify with. They go to work every day, their kids are in school. All these things have been thrown out the window. I'm going to tell you something. People are having to face the one thing they don't want to face, which is yourself and others. And the old sense of being a community, everybody watching out for one another, all your neighbors, all your friends. And books are being read more. A lot of things are being thought about on a level that's much deeper and personal than it had been, because there's more time to do them. I've been an essential employee the entire time. So to me, I haven't had that as much, but I have had the danger of knowing that I'm an essential employee, which means I'm expendable. I do a job I enjoy doing, but it's dangerous. But what are we really left with in life? We take away your job, you take away all your awards, you take away all your merits, you take away your sense of everything that is accomplishment. And when you go and look at somebody else and say, wow, this is me. No, it's your family, your neighbors, your friends. It's that introspective looking into yourself that I think defines a civilization, because every person and how they interact with one another defines a civilization. We've been led to believe on social media and everything that you can post anything you want and find anybody to agree with you. But this is really what life is about. Sitting at the end of the day, watching the sunset, or waking up in the morning, having a cup of coffee, seeing your kids, seeing your pet, seeing your wife or husband, seeing your parents, thinking how precious life is. It is extremely precious. So, someone in this and say, what have we really learned? How does it all come full circle? And I always try to do that. How does poetry reading come full circle? How does all of this come full circle to be effective? Reading and familiarizing yourself with writing is a lot like familiarizing yourself with your daily routines. Seeing those routines for what they are and how they work and how they don't work. Probably most of us never thought about it. You're spending more time with your kids. In a lot of ways, you're teaching them. My sister is a teacher, so I know how important that job is. You're getting your children involved in social issues. You may not be out marching, whether you believe one way or the other, but in some sense, you're living in the moment. My father's final words to me the night before he died was, moment to moment. And someday that's all going to go into the reality of a book I want to write, and that may be the title of it. But you live moment to moment. You live in the moment. That is your life, this moment. You never elaborated on it, but I knew him enough to get the gist of it. And going through all these horrible things with him, with pancreatic cancer and things, I'm used to seeing, unfortunately, tragedy. And I'm used to seeing hope. I'm used to seeing faith. And seeing those things that uplift you. So what we've learned is that there is art, there is beauty, there is togetherness through our common thoughts, feelings, and love for one another. There's hatred in the world, but we're all equal, whether you're black, brown, white, red, yellow. We're all a human community. We're all going through this. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, whether you have name recognition or you don't. So, I will do more with this. I want to do a couple interviews. My good news for all of you is that our friend John Nolivanko, Little John from Little John's Polka Show, has been in a hospital the past 2 months. I've been very worried about him and talking about him, and I think I did a whole podcast on Little John. He's out of the hospital, and he's home, and he's still in recovery, but I want you all to be ready, because Little John, I wouldn't be surprised if he's back on that polka show of his soon. He's going to be back on it. He's great. He's a little scrapper, that guy. I love that guy's show. I don't like polkas, but I love that guy's show. He really follows a theme, like I'm doing today. So I want to end this by welcoming Little John back to this new reality. God bless you all, and thank you. Bye.